time for Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne. Presented by Les Schwab Tires. It's live, local talk that matters to you. Now, here's Brent and Dave.
And welcome to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart along with Dave Bourne. It is a fabulous Willamette Valley winter day, although we should watch for serious weather tonight. You might want to go home early tonight so your car doesn't get blown off the road.
No kidding. I'm getting new tires in the rear, too.
This is a show, the noon hour, here with you at KYKN Monday through Friday, where we talk about local issues and ideas and institutions and all that good stuff, and individuals. And I've got an individual in the studio here today that I have great respect for. I've served on a board with, which was highly entertaining, I must say. And with us in the studio today is Kevin Mannix. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
I wish I had your voice, actually. Maybe we should change jobs.
That's maybe great. I have a voice for radio, but I don't have a face for radio, or do have a face for radio, whatever.
Kevin Mannix is a local attorney who's had his fingers in a number of things for a number of decades. He's been a community leader in Salem and Marion County and the whole region for a long time, and he's also served the legislature in both branches of the legislature for a long time. How many years?
10 years in the House and a partial term in the Senate.
So, and we have him. We're going to talk a little bit about redistricting coming up in 2020, right? Will be a new census, and the census will kick off the need to redistrict, meaning redraw the lines where all of our political boundaries are, right?
Right. Well, the Supreme Court requires that we have one person, one vote in our redistricting process. That's a decision that goes back to the 60s. And that means that for the House and the Senate, we need to make sure that there's pretty much equal population for each district. But the redistricting process is how you draw the lines. And every 10 years after the census, we do need to redraw those lines. The question is, who redraws those lines and how are they redrawn and what goes into what's considered when they do the redrawing?
All right, we're going to dive deep into this. But right now, I would like to make sure that say we've got a listener who has never heard of your name. Quite possible, maybe. I don't know, but you've been a community leader, and I know you've been a leader in the Catholic community, Catholic schools, and tell us a little bit about that. Blanchette, indeed, right?
Well, in fact, Suzanne and I came to Oregon in 1974 as we'd like to call ourselves pioneers. My wife and I were both Foreign Service kids, so we spent years abroad growing up, and we ended up meeting at the University of Virginia. And when we decided to get married, I thought, well, we're in Virginia, right? And she said, so let's adopt a home state. So we studied up on the 50 states, and we adopted Oregon as where we wanted to be. So we both took our degrees in 1974, got married at the campus parish at the University of Virginia on June 1, and the next morning honeymooned on our way to Oregon, and we've been Oregonians ever since.
Wow. Nice move.
And Suzanne is still a nurse here in town. She got her bachelor's of science in nursing, and I got my law degree all within a week, both at the University of Virginia. And yes, we're still married.
Well done. That is quite an accomplishment, actually. And too many people don't make it that far.
Well, we've been blessed, and we have three wonderful children, and all of them went through Catholic schools in this community, St. Joseph, and then Blanchette Mid High and High School, and we're very proud of what they've been able to accomplish. Our daughter is in New York. She went to University of Portland, then went to New York, and she's in marketing in social media in Manhattan, and loves that work. We have a son who is an engineer. And he is in New Orleans.
I like engineers.
And yes,
I got a son who's going to be one of those.
I know. And then another son who graduated from PSU and then decided that he was a volunteer firefighter, loved it, enlisted in the Air Force, became an Air Force firefighter. And then after serving his term in the Air Force, he, by the way, he was deployed to Afghanistan, too, which had us praying every day. On his return, he found a job with the Shoreline Fire Department. So he is a firefighter just north of Seattle in Shoreline. So none of our kids are in Oregon. And the rest of our family are all on the East Coast. We were the I have an older brother now who's moved to Oregon, but the rest of them are all back there in the East Coast.
They've adopted their own states. So we've got Kevin Mannix here on Newsmakers. He was the Republican Party chair one time, a while back, right? And served in the House and the Senate, both as a Democrat and a Republican, going back to 1997, 99, et cetera. But you're here today. I want to mention something about
Please. That, though. I did serve as a Democrat in the legislature. I was elected that way. And then after I finished that service, I left the legislature. I served out my term as a Democrat. And Senate President Peter Courtney would even tell you that as a member of the caucus, I was obedient to the procedures of the caucus. But substantively, it was my conscience and my constituents. And I found myself out of tune with the Democratic Party. So after I left the legislature, I became a Republican within a week after leaving. But I served out the season with the team. And then after I became a Republican, all right, I'm on that team. Neither team is perfect. And I always tell people that, but I'm much more comfortable with the Republican team than I was with the Democrat team.
And I love the old Reagan quote about formerly being a Democrat, right? That why'd you leave the Democratic Party? He says, I didn't. They left me. Well, did you feel as though there was a shift away from your core values?
Yes. In fact, the joke is in Virginia, I was considered a liberal Democrat. And I came to Oregon and I found that I guess I was a conservative Democrat, and there wasn't much room for conservative Democrats in the Oregon Democratic Party. So I went over to the Republican Party, where I guess I'm a moderate Republican.
I get it. I love it. All right, let's talk about redistricting. They're going to draw new lines. A lot of times a lot of monkey business happens when that happens. It's a political process in Oregon, at least. They're going to draw new lines in terms of which House district we're going to be in, which Senate district, and so forth. So we're going to see something on the ballot, correct?
Well, I hope so. I'm chief petitioner for an initiative to change the redistricting process. Right now, redistricting under the Oregon Constitution is done by the legislature itself. And they get together and they draw the new lines up. And it's based on population shifts. You've got to make adjustments in the boundaries so that each district has a roughly equal population. When you do that, how you draw those lines makes a big difference. And the legislature is self-interested in how they draw those lines. Certainly there will be incumbent protection, as there was in 2010 when, for the first time in many years, the legislature in decades was able to get together and come up with a redistricting plan. And sure, and it was an incumbent protection plan. That's what it was. Huh. So what I'm getting at is, over the years, there is a default. If the legislature cannot agree on a plan, then it goes to the Secretary of State. So we've had a lot of plans that have been drafted by secretaries of state. The reform movement nationally has been to move away from legislatures doing their own redistricting and having citizen commissions do it to reduce the partisanship and reduce the game playing and the gerrymandering that goes on. And we do have some gerrymandering in Oregon. If people take a look at the district maps, they have some very strange looking boundaries. And they were designed at the time to maximize the incumbent's protective position.
All right. So
we joked about that last week, didn't we?
Yeah.
Where they drew the line where the opposing person of the incumbent was, their house was out of sight of the boundary?
Well, in fact, back in 1990, when I was a sitting Democrat, one of my concerns was in the drawing of redistricting, there were some arguments that my neighborhood was going to be carved out of my district.
Probably.
And
that's
so,
happened, right?
Yeah, that has. I actually bought some property in the next part of the district that was sure to be in it, in case I'd have to build a house there and move there. It never happened. But if you really want to continue serving, sometimes you have to be thinking about these things, which you shouldn't have to.
No, you should.
There should be some continuity. So the proposal we have says, look, we'll have a citizen commission be in charge, and it will not be the legislature. And it also says that we're going to have some objective standards, which is basically the districts need to be maximally compact based on census tracts. And census tracts are these little plots that are all chosen by the Census Bureau, where they count the people in them, and they're set. So you can't fool around with them. They're set boundaries, and in this census tract, there's this many people. Well, as population shifts then, you take a look and you see, how can I have a district that's as close as possible within its parameters? And you can do this with computers now based on the census tracts. We take away all of the softball subjective standards, such as, oh, we want to have a community of interests. Oh, we want to have a competitive district. Those are all labels that are an excuse for gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm moving over here where there's a lot of Republicans and put mm-hmm. in my district for a community of interests. Or I'm moving over here where there's a lot of Democrats to put in my district because it makes it a competitive district. Yeah, for the next district, not mine. There's a bunch of subjective terms in the current provision that allows games and gerrymandering. And we're saying, don't do that. Let's just objectively establish these districts, and neither party comes out ahead. It's the citizens who come out ahead because they're closer physically to their representative or senator than they would be under the current system.
Well, I'm glad the proposal is to go before the voters, because if we left it up to the legislature with a supermajority in one party, they're going to draw it however they need to and however they want to favor one party, right? And that's the whole point.
Well, in fact, the good folks at the League of Women Voters are going to the legislature in the hopes that the legislature will refer out to the voters a reform measure. And I say, well, more power to you. I cannot see how the legislature would actually send out a reform measure that would take away their power to do redistricting. The only reason they might do it is because of something like what I have going. They may get nervous about this and try to come up with an alternative that also divests the legislature, but doesn't do it quite as dramatically.
All right, we're talking to Kevin Mannix here at KYKN 1430. It's Newsmakers at the Noon Hour with Brent D. Hart and Dave Bourne. We'll be right back.
Newsmakers continues with Brent D. Hart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome back, everyone. It's a pleasure to have Kevin Mannix in the studio with us today talking about gerrymandering and redrawing the district boundaries coming up after the 2020 census, and an initiative to try to get on the ballot so that we can take the politics out of it and let the algorithms take over, right? And then a citizen nonpartisan committee.
The nonpartisan committee is important in the sense that there's some other proposals out there for a bipartisan commission or a multipartisan commission. And my view is nonpartisan is the answer, that you're not trying to favor any party, and partisan coming from party. And having commissioners who are citizens who do not have a partisan background, our initiative says you can't have served in partisan office, including elective party office, for the previous 10 years in order to serve on this commission. And then we have county commissioners selecting the 11 members of the city commission to take it away from the legislature, to take it out of state government, because county commissioners are really separate from that. And by the way, a majority of county commissioners in the state are elected on a nonpartisan basis. Here in Marion County, they are elected as Republicans or Democrats, but in most of the counties, it's nonpartisan commissioners.
Yeah, including Polk County.
Yes.
Right across the river. So we're using the term gerrymandering, which we know to mean monkeying around with the borders to put the people in the borders that they want on the borders so the person will get elected, right? Where'd that term come from? It
goes back a couple of hundred years when in Massachusetts, a politician named Jerry had his district redrawn during redistricting so that it could favor his incumbency. And it had the shape of a salamander. Imagine, like little legs and a head and a tail, and it, you could see the salamander on the map. And the press picked up on this and said, oh, this is a new creature. It's a gerrymander in the shape of a salamander. And that became the popular name for fooling around with district lines to favor an incumbent or to favor one party or the other.
So let's talk about the party situation we've got. So we've got the Democrats in the House and the Senate. And in 2020, we should predict that they will have control of the House and the Senate. And this is obviously going to be a power issue for them, right?
Well, I think
so
it's
what kind
a power
of shade are
going to
throw
any,
at you?
It's a power issue for any legislators, because we're taking this power away from the legislature to draw their own lines and saying they should be drawn by a citizen commission and they should have objective standards, not subjective standards where they can play games. But you were about to ask me about the kind of argument they're going to make against it. Well, the big argument I've heard so far is, well, these 11 citizen commissioners are not being appointed in a properly apportioned by population so that each one of them would represent 1/11 of the state. And, of course, it's hard to do that if you have clusters of counties doing this. My answer is There are over 300 boards and commissions in the state of Oregon, most of them appointed by the governor, some of them with the advice and consent of the Senate, but not one of them. We've looked through all of them in the Secretary of State's Blue Book, trying to find one that's apportioned by population. And so far, the answer is none. None of them are apportioned by population. You just choose good people to be on a commission. Some of them are apportioned by counties, where they, the Land Conservation and Development Commission actually specifies clusters of counties to be represented. But none of them require that you have, you know, some sort of proportionate representation of commissioners. So this is a bogus argument that's already come out. The Attorney General's picked up on it. And we're going to have to push back and say, you've created a bogus argument. This is not meant to be proportionate. And of the 14 states that have already adopted citizen commissions, none of them say that the commissioners have to, you know, be proportionately representing the state. They have to be there to do a job, and in most instances, to be nonpartisan.
Well, it's good you're getting out in front of that, so because you're going to have people complain, hey, Portland has more people, so we should have more bodies, right?
They're going to complain that way, and we say, if you... Portland talks about diversity. Let's talk about geographic diversity. One of the problems we have in the state is we fail to discern the need to take a look at the differences around the state and the geographic diversity of the state. And then I'd add, so what is a commissioner who happens to be from Harney County? Does that commissioner really care about playing games about legislative district lines in Portland? No. They're going to be looking for how do we come up with an objective standard and draw all the lines properly.
Okay, so people, they like your idea. Let's say people like your idea. How do they help?
Well, right now we have a website for Common Sense for Oregon, and Common Sense for Oregon is a nonprofit which will be supporting this initiative. That's a good way for folks to go to Common Sense for Oregon and go to that website and let us know that you want to help. Right now we're in the ballot title process, so you can go online with the Secretary of State's initiative listings, and you'll see that the Attorney General has drafted a ballot title, and it's a problematic one, and I'll be filing a comment letter by Wednesday. But to some extent, for those who want to circulate petitions and do that sort of thing, we'd be in standby mode. But if folks want to let us know that they want to help, they can go on the website, send us a message.
Common Sense for Oregon. Okay. All right. Well, that is going to be a huge effort, and I applaud you, and I support you, and I would love to take the politics out of drawing the lines. It's crazy when you see little squigglies and all over the place, and you're drawing legislators out of their own districts, or you're only drawing in, you're adding to this area, you're only to draw in the Democrat or the Republican voters so that you can keep an incumbent in office.
Boy, crazy.
That is. And okay, so... independent commission, appointed 11 members, appointed by county commissioners, apportioned by county and not by population.
Right. We just clustered. There's 11 clusters of counties around the state. Now, for Multnomah County, they're high population, so we have them appoint one commissioner. Washington County's high population, so they appoint one commissioner. Clackamas County, almost as high population as Washington County, we pair them with Hood River County, and they appoint one commissioner. You go through the state, though. All of these counties are in clusters. They're adjoining to one another, and they each appoint one commissioner so that we have a geographic spread around the state. And the restriction is, again, these folks cannot have been county commissioners or legislators or have served in partisan office for the last 10 years. So there will not be an insider's game here.
If all goes well, when are we voting on this?
It'd be November 2020, which would be just in time for it to be passed.
Wow.
And some people will say, why are you doing a constitutional amendment? We have to, because we're replacing the current constitutional provision, which gives the legislature the power to redraw the lines.
Okay. Wow. That's good to know. I know you're involved in a lot of other things, and one of them is really going to impact the Mid-Valley here, and that is the multimodal facility proposed for the Brooks area, right? So try to explain what the goal of the effort is.
Sure. What we have is a situation where the Port of Portland is basically out of the business of container shipping. For decades since container shipping was established, the Port of Portland moved a tremendous volume of containers into and out of Oregon and the Northwest by ship, even though they had to go 110 miles up the river. There's Terminal T6 at the Port of Portland. Back in 2003, they moved 330,000 container units, so it was a big production. The Port of Portland, and this is a separate half-hour discussion, but basically they are out of the container business. Now it's Seattle and Tacoma that are the import and export sites for the Northwest for container shipping. And a problem has arisen where that means that businesses who are importing or exporting are trucking from Oregon right up I-5 into Seattle and Tacoma, adding to the congestion on the highways. It also has added to the expense for our farmers. We're an export state, and our farmers in the Willamette Valley have been paying more per container to get their shipping out by having to send it by truck. So the idea is to establish a facility in Brooks where folks can put their product in containers and put them on rail in Brooks to rail up to Tacoma or Seattle to the ports for shipping to the interior of the U.S., and then over time also put products on rail to go along the Columbia River to the interior of the U.S., because we do ship a significant amount of nursery products and other products into the interior. The big push, though, was the expense and problems for farmers who were trying to export to the Pacific, not being able to go to the Port of Portland anymore and having to go to Seattle, Tacoma, doing so by truck. Rail is less congestion, it's less fossil fuel use, it's less CO2 emissions, and at the same time, it absolutely does not add to congestion in the Portland area on I-5 or 205.
Yeah, so how does this intersect with the talks about replacing that I-5 bridge?
Well, you just used a word that I keep trying to tell people, don't talk about replacing the I-5 bridge. We need to be talking about transportation as a vision issue for Democrats and Republicans in the state. And it's one issue where I've seen significant bipartisanship, which is great. How do we help our businesses import and export, which also helps all of our citizens, it helps with jobs? The Columbia River Bridge, we need another bridge. But I avoid the word replacement because the existing bridge can still be a viable bridge. It just doesn't have nearly the capacity that it needs. And some folks have talked about replacing on site. Well, then for years, you're going to have terrible, even worse congestion while you're doing construction. No, build an additional bridge and put it across the Columbia River. And then we take the stress off the existing bridge. Maybe that'll give some opportunity to do some improvements there. But build a new bridge and get going with it. Understand that we're years past the need for a Columbia River bridge. And then folks say, well, let's talk about putting light rail in. The code word there is light. Don't say light rail. Say rail, because rail can move freight as well as passengers, and everyone would agree we need rail. And if they disagree about light rail, as Vancouver did, you can put light rail on regular rail. You can't put regular rail on light rail. Build a regular rail line that gives you the capability to move commuters, but certainly we need some more alternatives for our rail service north and south.
Well, you really nailed it when you talk about the farmers and the need to move the product and the cost when you're talking about a global market for their goods, right? Be it berries or wheat or grass seed. And, you know, they used to be able to barge it down the Columbia and put it on ship, right? And now we're going up I-5 and we have to go all the way into Washington. Now, we're going to have to take another break. We're going to come back here and we're going to talk about your role in this process. The political side and your role. You're listening to Newsmakers with Kevin Mannix in the studio as our guest. This is 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Newsmakers with Brent and Dave on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Hello and welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart along with Dave Bourne and our guest Kevin Mannix. We've been talking about redistricting, which hopefully we'll be voting on and how we do it in the 2020 election. In the meantime, a lot of states have already gone to a citizen committee and a commission that takes it out of the hands of partisan politics. Now we're talking a little bit about moving freight up and down the I-5 corridor and the thought pattern to get a Brooks facility that we multimodal, where we would take trucks, offload their freight onto a rail, and move it forward from there. Right, Kevin?
Yes.
All right. So there's a private entity. Who's behind all this?
We created the Oregon Port of Willamette Limited Liability Company. And I do want to separate my political work from this. This is actually a business project. I do run the Oregon Shipping Group, which is an advocacy group to support enhancing freight shipping in the state. And we've talked to the legislature about these issues. We supported the 2017 transportation package. So we're advocates for enhancing transportation throughout the state. That's one group that does advocacy, and that's my group. But separate from that, we created the Oregon Port of Willamette as a business entity to propose this facility for Brooks. And we've brought in investors. It's a limited liability company. Most of the members are farmers who themselves want to be able to see a shipping system that will work for the farmers of the Willamette Valley. There's also some businesses involved looking at the importation of goods side of things. And it's all about how do we create a system that's going to work better to move goods. And in this case, better means by rail, to connect up with the ports of Seattle and Tacoma for export. But over time, and this is the beauty of being entrepreneurs, we're looking at the Port of Coos Bay, which is the largest deep water port between San Francisco and Puget Sound, deserves to be considered as a major port, and is building up their Coos Bay rail line that runs into the Willamette Valley, which is the only way they can really move freight. And they just got another federal grant for $20 million to improve that line. They need and want to enhance their port. We support having a container shipping terminal in Coos Bay. The Coos Bay rail line can run into the Willamette Valley. The Portland and Western Railroad could connect with the Coos Bay rail line, and guess what rail line runs right by into the Brooks facility? The Portland and Western Railroad. So we create a valley presence to move goods in and out, and we're already looking at Seattle Tacoma. That's the first target. That exists. That's what you use. But let's enhance the Coos Bay capability. And that will be great for that port, and it'll be great for the folks in that community, but it can become a gateway port for the Northwest. So the Port of Willamette, we used a broad term to be looking at what we can do in the Willamette Valley, but also how we partner with the folks around the state to enhance transportation capability.
Do you have any rough idea on how much it can save in terms of shipping by rail instead of by truck?
For up to Seattle, Tacoma right now?
Yeah.
A year and a half ago, I would have told you $600 to $1,100. Now, with some efficiencies and the like, it's at least $100 per container. It's at least $100 and more likely $600 per container. Okay. And that's when you're selling your product, you know, cost of transportation is a factor.
Yeah, enormous. And time is money as well if you can get it up there faster by rail, right? Especially if it's a perishable good.
And you brought this up. Predictability and reliability are key factors. And we can be building trains in Brooks where we'll have a schedule and we'll let folks know you get your container in here by this time. We'll get it up to Seattle, Tacoma. Tacoma has three docks where you can run rail right up to the dock. So you can be running right next to a ship and move on to a particular ship. Seattle has one such dock. And I was on the phone this morning with the container development guy for Seattle, Tacoma, talking about the progress on our project, the whole idea being that we want to set up this coordinated effort where we know a certain ship is coming in with product that's designated for, say, Oregon, rail it down to Brooks, and then you can redistribute it from Brooks. You don't need to truck it through Portland or run down I-5.
Well, looking into the future, now I am hearing you say this could benefit the people that run the ports in Tacoma and in Seattle. This could benefit congestion on I-5 and the traffic. This could benefit Coos Bay, and this could benefit the farmers in our region, in Marion, Polk counties and beyond, that grow the goods that have to move. Who's against this?
So right? Far, no one is against this. Now, this is a choice that has to be made. The legislature set up a system where for this intermodal facility, there will be competition for the grant. And five competitors initially submitted proposals in December. And then in February, Brooks and Millersburg were chosen as the two finalists. So our Brooks project is competing with the city of Millersburg, just north of Albany, for this grant. And we've submitted a comprehensive proposal on September 27. We answered some questions and a supplement on November 15th. And the Oregon Department of Transportation and Business Oregon, the economic development folks, are reviewing the proposals. And then they'll be making recommendations to the Oregon Transportation Commission in January Probably hear from them officially. The commission will hear from them in February and will likely make a decision by their March meeting as to whether Millersburg or Brooks gets the grant award. So we're in competition here.
Okay. So is this grant, just real quick, is this coming out of like a Connect Oregon kind of transportation grant, or is it coming out of economic development grant?
It's Connect Oregon lottery money.
Right.
So I don't feel guilty. It's not. It's people pay into the lottery, but it's voluntary, and the money is for economic development.
Indeed. So, and going back, I'll tell you that I'm a proponent of these Connect Oregon grants and the programs, and they've passed through lots of legislatures with lots of different partisan swings, which I like. At least our legislature is sometimes working together to get us, you know, strong rail, strong roads, but a lot of time it goes to airports and seaports and rail, right?
Well, in fact, that's where
the money's
supposed
to go. My
Oregon Shipping Group is still involved. I've gone to the speaker's office to say we want to be supportive of a Columbia River Bridge. I've been talking to passenger rail advocates, letting them know that the Brooks Project is about freight, but we've designed it so that it will not in any way be in the way of possible commuter rail traffic between Salem and Portland. The Portland and Western Line runs from Salem into Portland, and also there's right now ODOT is properly looking at the Union Pacific line on the east side of Brooks as the main the Amtrak line, and that's properly the first priority, but there's no reason why we shouldn't be looking to the future and saying, well, we could have a commuter line, not necessarily an Amtrak line, running from Salem to Kaiser. There's Kaiser Station has a station they built there that can accommodate passenger rail. Yeah. And I'm just saying that the whole point is to be open to a vision as to the future, and we've made sure nothing we're doing in Brooks gets in the way of passenger rail, and it actually creates a good atmosphere for passenger rail because we'll be improving that rail line. That means it's easier to run passenger rail on it.
Wow. So light rail from the Mid-Valley? Well,
not light rail.
Rail.
Commuter rail.
Commuter rail. Okay.
I want to emphasize that because commuter rail to me means we've created some important rail lines that can be for any purpose. And then you can, if you can justify it, run passenger rail on the same line. And that's what's being done with the Union Pacific line with Amtrak. You know, you've got freight trains running up and down. So we want to be visionary about the long term. What are we going to do about moving people and goods in this valley and in this state? And rail is an important option. On the other hand, if I were inside Portland looking around, sometimes buses are more efficient and more doable. I mean, you can make those arguments. I don't want to get sucked into those arguments. I can just tell you that what we're trying to do in Brooks works for everybody.
Are you going to run into jurisdictional issues or power struggles with TriMet?
I think not. In fact, we've met with TriMet and had good discussions with them because we're not trying to do anything that interferes with what they want to do. And if anything, what we do helps them with what they want to do. There is a commuter line from Wilsonville to Beaverton right now, and it's on Portland and Western Rail. And the same rail part of the same rail system that we're going to use for Brooks. Portland Western is a short line railroad that's wholly within the state of Oregon. It's not one of these first class railroads. We've been working hand in glove with the Portland and Western about these plans. They've been wonderful about what the schedule could be and if there is commuter rail ever, how we make sure that we can arrange the schedule so they can move their trains for that. At the same time, we're just planning for freight, and all we're doing is freight, but we're not doing it stupidly. We're doing it intelligently so that if passenger were to be running, the system is designed to allow for that.
Well, a lot of people forget about trains. In Salem, they go right through town, of course. Along the waterfront, they go through town. In Independence, goes right through town. And there's sometimes a movement to
get rid of rail.
Get rid of rail and lines that have not been used for a while, but they're going into an industrial area or they're going into an agricultural area and they want to turn it into, what do they call it, rail to to
rails
trail.
Rails to trails. Yeah.
And then you can never get it back.
Well, the position I've taken on behalf of the shipping group is very straightforward. In most instances, the reason the rail was there in the first place is actually how the community was built around it. Communities were built around rail, and that's why rail runs right through town. And in some instances, what you do is you look, how do you accommodate rail within that town? Salem has done a good job of that with improved crossings, with overpasses in a couple of places, so you do have a way of getting over. Mission Street's a great example, major project, so that you can get over the rail if there's a blockage or there's a train staying at the station too long. So there are ways of accommodating rail. And we want to encourage that so that towns and cities in the state get state and federal help. The biggest problem right now is local communities usually cannot afford to improve those crossings, and too many officials higher up in government say they're the ones that have to pay for it. No, this is a system for all of us.
And a lot of times it's hard to get a crossing, bureaucratic red tape and so forth, and going through ODOT and the railroads themselves. And all right, we're talking to Kevin Mannix, and you are the executive director of?
Of the Port of Portland. A
new job.
Boy, there's a misstatement.
Oregon Port
Executive
of Willamette.
Executive director of the Oregon Port of Willamette.
LLC. We're talking about moving freight up and down I-5 into Oregon.
The word port moved me in the wrong direction.
Coos Bay in the future for regional farmers, agricultural interests, and actually to reduce congestion. I like it. We're going to be back. You're with us for one more segment here. We're here with Kevin Mannix on 1430 KYKN. Salem's listening.
Newsmakers continues with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart, and it has been a pleasure to have Kevin Mannix on us with us this hour. Kevin has long been a community leader in Salem, Kaiser, Marion Polk County for the state and the House and the Senate as an advocate, ballot measure. Advocate and author, right? Many of those.
I'm the author of 5 successful citizen initiatives. We put 8 on the ballot. 5 of them passed, and that's more successful initiatives than anyone else in Oregon history.
And
key word is successful.
Successful. That's right.
There's someone else who put 22 on the ballot, but as I recall, only 2 of them passed.
You've got a winning record, which is more than the Beavers can say, right? ouch! Ooh. That one hurt. Hey, I love the Beavers, but come on. I also like Green Bay Packers, and they don't have a winning record. You have a better record than the Green Bay Packers. Even so, you're going to go for 9 in 2020 with the redistricting.
I want to go for 6 wins.
Yes,
with redistricting, only initiative I'm working on for 2020. I think it's real important to focus on this, and we'll see how this goes. We're out there. We're in the ballot title process. There's this discussion in the legislature. The League of Women Voters and a coalition of political party types are working on a different version, which they call a multi-partisan approach to redistricting. I prefer the non-partisan approach.
Yeah, it really gets troublesome whether it's one of the major parties or when you try to include a party that has 0.4% of Oregon voters and try to include them and may have more say than they need. I like the nonpartisan approach as well and take the politics out of the redistricting and the gerrymandering and so forth. I want to circle back. Other states, you mentioned other states have already done this or this is already in place?
14 states have provisions in place. Now, 4 passed them in November on the ballot. And I'm still studying up on the details on those, but all of them have created a form of citizen commission to be in charge of the redistricting process, so the legislature itself will not do redistricting in those 14 states.
So it's a trend. It's a national trend.
Yes. We can't say we started this one. There's some others we can say we started, but not this one.
All right. So for the listener, I want them to make sure that they pay attention in the next couple of years as this comes up. And we'll have you back on, obviously, as you gain steam, as you get your ballot title, as you get all your signatures in, and so on and so forth.
And I should explain what the ballot title process is about. The ballot title isn't just a few words. It's actually 190 words. It's written by the Attorney General. Then you can go to the Supreme Court to have a challenge. It's what appears on the ballot. And the reason that was set up was someone might have a 10,000-word initiative. Ours is a few hundred words, but they may be so long that you can't put that on the ballot for people to see. So you put it in the voter's pamphlet, and there is what's called the ballot title that goes on the ballot itself. And it has 15 words for a caption, 25 words for a result of yes vote, 25 words for a result of no vote, 125 words to summarize it, sort of to let the voter know what they're voting on. And that is a very important process. Mm-hmm. The Attorney General gets to draft a ballot title. We get to comment on it, and I'll be filing a commentary letter on Wednesday because the draft ballot title that we're getting, we're not happy with. We don't think it properly describes the initiative without going into details. The essence of this means that once you have a ballot title is when you can go out to gather your 145,000 signatures. You can't gather signatures on this. And we're starting early because there's a July 2020 deadline, and we don't want to be waiting till December 2019 to find out what the ballot title is to start circulating petitions. We want to start earlier.
Okay, that is great. Thank you, Kevin Mannix. And let's finish up a little bit on the multimodal, intermodal.
Multimodal is the same concept. It means moving from one transportation mode to another. And in this case, it's intermodal because it's truck to rail or rail to truck.
Okay. The timing for the grant that you're talking about in terms of getting a grant to create this facility, and you're in competition with Millersburg. What's the timing on that again?
We'll know, we think, by March. The Oregon Transportation Commission will hear recommendations from Business Oregon and from ODOT, and we'll make a choice. Technically, they could say we're not going to do anything. I don't think that's the real choice that's going to be made. The legislature wants this facility. They appropriated the funds for it. So the choice will be Millersburg or Brooks. They don't get to divide up the money. There's a winner and there's a loser. And we're working real hard to be the winner. And then from that point on, we get to work on the project.
So the commission makes the decision.
Yes.
Right. And is that proportioned by population?
No, and the Transportation Commission isn't proportioned by population either, to our early point.
Good to know. All right. So the money, you talk about the money being apportioned. The money is coming from the lottery funds.
Right.
So is that the funds that are going to build the facility?
The basic part of the facility, our budget is actually, it's going to cost more than the $23.75 million to build a complete facility. You can build a basic facility that'll serve our needs at the start for $23.75, and you can use the money to get this thing going. But we planned to build a comprehensive facility. And we see this grant as providing the opportunity. We're already working on this to apply for matching federal funds to expand the facility to even better meet the needs of the Mid-Willamette Valley and to seek federal transportation funds to improve roads in the area around the Brooks facility. The River Road and Brook Lake Road intersection, the width of Brook Lake Road, the ramps on and off I-5 at Brook Lake Road. All we can and we will use the state funds as we can match federal grants. And right now, federal infrastructure grants favor rural areas. Brooks fits that.
Indeed.
And they favor proposals where they're only being asked to do a 50-50 match.
And how does the role of DeFazio affect that?
Well, that's significant. Congressman DeFazio will now be the chair of the House Committee on Transportation Infrastructure. He's extremely knowledgeable about transportation issues, and Oregon has an opportunity, if we've got appropriate projects to bring to federal government attention, to get good attention from Congress, which is a very good thing.
All right. So let's say Brooks is chosen. We get this thing built. What is the role of the Oregon Port of Willamette LLC? Managing the facility?
Well, the Port of Willamette will own the facility and will also operate the facility, may contract with a business that is skilled at operating an intermodal facility, may contract with others to build what's called a transload facility or to operate it. That's where you move from 53-foot trailers to 40-foot containers and vice versa. That's transload. That's an element. It's not a necessary element, but it's a good element. So the Port of Willamette will be a business in the Brooks community running this operation through other entities.
Well, if you're about town or you're in his office or you have him in your studio, there is never a shortage of things to talk about with Kevin Mannix.
Glad to be of help.
To wrap this up, this last conversation is about an intermodal facility that is proposed for Brooks or Millersburg that would take trucks off the road that's hauling goods out of Oregon because we're exporting, get it up to Seattle and Tacoma faster, cheaper, and possibly even get it from the Mid-Valley to Coos Bay. Lots of great things.
And we'll build up business so much that our trucker friends will have more trucking short-haul business with Brooks because we want to enhance the transportation that's happening.
Everybody wins. Thanks, Kevin, for being here. This is 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This has been Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.